everyone. I'm Haley Allam, and this is Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you're a parent new to Luxembourg, then this is the podcast for you. From crèches to crèmes, we'll cover everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. Moin, everyone, and welcome to the show. Thanks so much for listening. One thing I really love about doing this podcast is that it gives a voice to the English-speaking women living in Luxembourg. In addition to the particulars about life here, we also cover topics about life in general, which can be a fit for anyone of a certain age and stage in life. Today on the show, I've invited Diana Reed, a registered dietitian nutritionist, to talk about the non-aesthetic and nutritional side of taking a GLP-1. Last week on the show, we talked about personal experiences on a GLP-1, so I felt like it was only fair to have a more medical discussion about what's happening behind the scenes in your body. So today we're going to talk about side effects, risks, and benefits of the medication. What I love about this episode is that it's not pro or anti-medicine, and spoiler alert, you've got to do your own research and decide if it's right for you. But chances are, if you've landed on this episode, it probably means that you're curious about taking a GLP-1, or you're already taking one. Or maybe you have a good friend who's taking one. If so, please share that episode. And since I'm on the subject, if you like the show, leaving a review on Apple or Spotify really helps the show get discovered. Merci Filmus, and enjoy the show. Diana Reed, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Is this your third or fourth time?
I think it's the third time.
Okay.
Third time's the charm?
Third time's the charm.
Well, not three strikes and I'm out.
No, absolutely not. Okay, all of good. Your episodes are amazing. Today, we are going to talk about the nutritional aspects of taking a GLP-1.
Yep.
If you're listening to these in order, I have just put out an episode where a friend of mine, very brave soul, and I talk about our personal experience on GLP-1. Basically, we presented it as, especially my friend told the story of kind of a caterpillar turns into a butterfly. And even when we were in that episode, I was like, that's not really fair because a lot of things happen and there are a lot of risks. And if you don't do the lifestyle changes and diet, and you might lose all your muscle and fall into a puddle on the floor.
It's a complicated topic and it's one that we're still getting a lot of research and data on. So I don't think there's any one right answer yet, but there are definitely some things that can be done to make everybody's experience hopefully healthier and better.
That's another thing that I want to talk about is I feel like we're in the wild west of this. Yes. The doctors are like, I don't know what the maintenance plan is. But before we talk about the specifics, give me a little bit of your background and why you're so passionate about this.
I've been a dietitian for about 14, 15 years. A few years of that, actually, because this is my second career. So a few years of that was in the U.S. before I moved here to Luxembourg. And then I have been practicing here for, I think, 7 years now as a registered dietitian. So I work in a private practice. One of my specialties is eating disorders. So you'll hear me talk a little bit about my concerns about some of these medications in regards to that particular topic. And then I also tend to work a lot with children, families, especially in the area of neurodivergence. And then my biggest interest these days, probably because I'm a woman in her mid-50s, is the intersection of kind of women's health and the menopause transition and the things that we need to do to really protect our health during this time and make sure that we're strong for the next 50 years.
Love that. Love that. Let's say that you've made the decision to take a GLP-1 for whatever reason.
Yep.
Whatever reason. What is like baseline things that you need to know so that you don't lose all your muscle and fall into a puddle on the floor and die of osteoporosis?
Backing up a little bit, we want to consider before we take one, typically, is this going to be the right thing for the right person at the right time? Let's just take some examples. If you have a history of an eating disorder, any type of disordered eating in your past, I would think really carefully and I would have conversations with your doctor and or your psychologist about that. Is this something that could be triggering? Because we do know, especially for women in midlife who are going through a lot of body changes, it can be triggering to gain weight during that time of life. It can cause people to start to go back to some of those eating disorder habits maybe they had in their teens or 20s. So I do think it's really important to just take a pause and make sure that this isn't something that is potentially going to open up some old wounds or put somebody at risk for relapse for something. So that's one. The other, is it something that ultimately is going to make you healthier? So there's a lot of talk these days, especially, you know, in the US, when you think about people who are trying to lose the last 5 or 10 pounds. My perspective would be these meds are not a good idea for that particular subset of people. Basically, because number one, there are risks with the meds. And unless you have other health risks, whether it might be diabetes, whether it might be kidney disease, cardiovascular risk, as well as carrying significant extra weight, the risks might outweigh the benefits for people that are going for, as they might say on the internet, the vanity weight, which I don't like that phrase. But we can talk a little bit more about what some of the risks are. And then the reason I recommend people don't do that is because the risk of regaining weight as well can be a little bit challenging.
That was initially what put me off, actually. So I did it completely wrong. I had a friend who it looks amazing always, and she just wanted to lose like 10, 15 pounds. Mm-hmm. And her doctor gave it to her. And I was like, she's getting it. She'll definitely give it to me.
Yeah,
I weighed significantly more than her. Still do. So I just got into it by accident without thinking like long-term. Mm-hmm. But originally when I heard about these, you hear like as soon as you go off them, you gain all the weight back.
Yeah.
So does that mean you need to be prepared to be on them for forever?
That's a really good question and one that we don't have 100% an answer for. As you said, I think at the beginning, it is a little bit like the Wild West. And while we have lots more studies now than we even had 6 months or 12 months ago, there's still a lot we don't know. So the more recent studies do show that for at least 50% of the people, the weight does come back. And it usually comes back within 1 to 2 years.
I don't know if you saw Oprah just put out a book called Enough, and it's her story. And then she had like very big, very public weight gain. Her thing is that she's going to be on it for the rest of her life in the same way that someone who has high blood pressure would be on medication for the rest of their life. Because if you have obesity physiologically, that's something that you need to treat for chronic.
There's one perspective that says that is likely. And I think it's probably right. But I also think we don't have enough data on these medications yet in the long-term use. So I also feel a little bit uncomfortable
about
that. As a dietitian and a healthcare provider, setting people's expectations that this is a medication that's only a few years old and you might be on it forever. And we still don't know what all the side effects are. I think when I look at some of the things that I counsel people on, one would be exactly that weight regain. And what we know about the weight regain, and there's been a lot of studies on this, is when we're losing the weight, and we can go back and talk about this again a little bit more, we tend to lose lean mass. Up to 40% of the weight that we lose is lean mass. So that can be muscle. So it's still more fat mass than lean mass. But the problem is the quicker we lose the weight and the more weight we lose, if we stop the medications, when the weight comes back, the muscle doesn't necessarily come back. The fat comes back. And we have metabolic shifts that slow down our metabolism. Every time we go through what we call a weight cycle, where we diet, we lose some weight, we stop dieting, we gain some weight. The body composition, there's been studies that show this. So the more cycles of what we call weight cycling,
like
basically.
The yo-yo?
Yeah, the yo-yo dieting, exactly. The more that happens, the more that we are edging closer towards what we call sarcopenia or medically significant muscle loss, and we're increasing our fat mass. So each time that happens, we're actually getting less healthy, not more health. And so for me, that's something really concerning. Mm-hmm. The other piece to that is there have been some new studies that have shown that the more weight cycles somebody has, the more likely, again, 2.5 times more likely to develop this sarcopenia and 5.5 times more likely to have fractures. We also get into bone risk.
How much muscle loss are we talking to the sarcopenia, and how can you keep track of your muscles?
That's going to depend on the person, right? It's going to depend on where they started. It's going to depend on their age. It's going to depend on their gender. It's going to depend on their cycle of dieting. So this goes back to my first point in terms of eating disorders and things. The data that I was just talking about says that individuals that have weight cycled 5 or more times have a 5.5 higher risk of fractures.
I see. Okay.
So we want to look at, and this kind of goes back to your question, should we be on them forever? from that perspective, it might be a better idea to start low, go slow, not try and lose tons and tons of weight in a couple of months, and plan on staying on them on a lower dose for a long period of time.
How long is long?
We don't know. There's a lot of, in the US especially, the microdosing and creating sort of maintenance profiles or maintenance treatment plans. But we don't have a particular set of guidelines here in Europe, to my knowledge, in the UK and the US, in terms of what is the ideal strategy. In my work as a dietitian, I have a lot of people come in and say, what I really want to do is I'm going to take one of these just for a couple of months, and I'm going to lose a bunch of weight, and then I'll go off them because then I'll feel really good about myself, and then I'll be able to keep up my habits. And it's a great theory, great intentions. It sounds good. The problem is we know that once you go off the medications, the weight does tend to come back. And the food noise and all of those things. So it's not that somebody's failed or is broken, but we also know that the faster people lose weight, actually the faster it comes back. And again, the more fat comes back.
You mentioned it's new. We just don't have the historical data on what happens if you stay on it forever. But haven't people with diabetes been on these for a long time?
Yeah, that's a really good point. A long time in this day and age is hard to define. There is one version of these meds that appeared in, I think, as early as 2005. And that was, we had semaglutide, we had liraglutide, we had Victoza, Trulicity, a number of these other meds. These are U.S. names. Things like Ozempic have only been around actually since 2017, 2018. So we don't have as much data. The other thing I think to know about the diabetes versions of these medications is in many cases, they're actually a lower dose than the weight loss medications.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, because they're designed for a different purpose. So they're more to help with insulin sensitization, insulin production, blood sugar control. And it was through those medications, those original diabetes forms of these medications, that it was noticed that there were these effects on appetite and weight and things like that.
I actually think that here in Luxembourg, you can only get the original intended for diabetes. So I think they have Wegovy, they have Mounjaro. I don't even know if they have Ozempic.
We do have Ozempic. Yeah. So originally, to my knowledge, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a prescriber. To my understanding, Ozempic and Rybelsus.
Yes, have that here.
Are the two that were originally licensed and approved for individuals with type 2 diabetes. As of, I think, February 1st, February 2nd, Mounjaro is now also approved in Luxembourg, but again, only for individuals with type 2 diabetes.
Right.
That second case would most likely be people with type 2 diabetes who also have a higher body weight. So I believe it's a BMI of over 30.
I didn't have type 2 diabetes. I had, because I went on a blood test, I guess, before, because I was like, dude, what's happening with me? And I was a little bit insulin resistant.
Yep.
I would like CNS to cover that because I think that counts for something. But I just felt from my very first shot so much better on the medicine than I have felt in years. Yeah. And I think it's because of insulin resistance or sugar metabolizing or something like that.
A lot of people find that they've struggled with their eating, with food noise, like you mentioned a second ago, with feeling out of control around food. Insulin resistance can absolutely give people lots of cravings, make them feel very low energy, because it basically means that your blood sugar is either too high or too low, that your pancreas is either over or undershooting. And your body just doesn't feel good. It's also a state of more inflammation. It can affect your energy levels, all kinds of things. So it does make sense if the medication is improving overall insulin and glucose regulation that you're going to feel better.
Sure. So in that case, that sort of is a medical reason to be on it, right?
Yeah, I can't second guess.
What's wild is that my doctor said, oh, it's not a big deal. You don't need to change anything. Keep an eye on it. It may get worse later, but for now, it's really not a big deal.
One of the things we do know that, especially for women, as we get older and in that perimenopause transition, estrogen, when it decreases, estrogen is considered an anti-inflammatory in our body. So when estrogen starts to fluctuate and go all over the place and decreases, that can create more inflammation in our body. So that can start to lead to insulin resistance. The other piece, going back to muscle, is that basically from age 30 on, we start to lose muscle mass just naturally, anywhere from 3 to 8% per decade. So naturally, our muscle is decreasing. And then if we find that because muscle is very important for glucose regulation and insulin sensitivity, this loss of muscle just from a natural aging process, again, leaves us more at risk for things like insulin resistance.
Ugh, that sucks.
So there's genetics, there's age, there's muscle. There's all kinds of reasons why, especially for us women in the 40s, early 50s, that insulin resistance does become more common.
Actually, now that I think about it, another reason I got on the bandwagon was because my husband made a commitment to get in shape and he went to the gym for like 3 months and oh my God,
yeah,
he looks great. And I was like, that is so unfair. Here I am busting my ass and I think I lost a kilo.
Women's bodies are very different. And the menopause transition, as you and I have talked about, is really hard because let's go back to that just natural muscle loss. When we lose muscle, our metabolism slows. Not a lot, but a little. And then because of estrogen shifts in our body starts to panic a little bit. So one of the ways that it helps try and regulate itself is fat cells around the midsection actually produce a really minor form of estrogen. But our body's in a strange way trying to protect us by adding more fat around the middle.
Good times.
Yeah, it's delightful.
Clearly, I have the profile. I'm feeling a little bit better about my decision, even though I just did it because my friend was doing it. How do we make sure that we don't have sarcopenia?
Sarcopenia.
And how do we keep track of muscle and all that?
I'll back up even a little bit before that and just talk about nutrition as a whole, if that's okay.
Sure.
So some of the things we know about these meds, of course, is that they reduce our appetite. For some people, that's delightful and great and wonderful, and they don't have food noise like we talked about. Some people, it becomes really hard to eat. And in those cases, I do get quite concerned that the med dose may be too high. Because if people are not even able to take in 1,000, 1,500 calories, we can't actually get all the nutrition we need in a really low calorie intake.
And is that when like your hair starts falling out and you get saggy skin or what happens?
Essentially, nutrition deficiencies have been found in as short as 6 months in individuals that are taking these medications. So things like calcium, certainly protein, which we'll talk about in a second, iron, vitamin B12, fiber, vitamin D. So from a nutritional perspective, the very first thing we want to do is make sure that we're eating enough food.
That's obviously individual, but like minimum, you've got to be hitting more than 1,000 calories.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I would say probably more than 1,200. But again, it really does depend on where you're starting. It depends on your other health markers, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So what I usually tell people is I still do want you eating 3 meals a day. They might be smaller, but I want you eating 3 meals a day. We start by really focusing on protein.
Here it comes.
It's so annoying.
Kill yourself with protein.
But we really do. And it's anywhere from 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight.
I have to stop you there.
Yep.
When you say 1.5 to 2 kilograms of body weight, my brain just like freezes.
I would say minimum of 100 grams of protein. Some people are going to go all the way up to 150.
How do you know your grams though? Can you give me like size of the palm?
Yeah, something the size of your palm if you're eating meat-related animal products. And you're going to want that 3 to 4 times a day. So it's really hard if you're not very hungry. So this is where I do work with people. I have a list of the protein content of foods. We talk about supplements like protein shakes or bars or things like that if people's appetite is really low. But I have a bit of a pyramid, and the base of my pyramid is protein. So we really look at getting enough protein. And then the next thing we look at is fiber, because that's important for gut health. For us midlife women, it's important for managing cholesterol. It's also important because these medications do slow down our digestive tract. And a lot of people end up constipated.
I didn't, thank God, have this, but what I had was thirst. Very thirsty.
Interesting. Yeah. We do find that a lot of people actually aren't thirsty at all. And so one of the right alongside fiber on that second tier of the pyramid for me is hydration. Because if we just take in a lot of fiber without hydration, then we're more constipated. So fiber, obviously, ideally form of fruits, vegetables, whole grains. The challenge with fiber for a lot of people is it takes up a lot of space. It takes up a lot of real estate in our gut.
Yeah.
So one of the other things I do is I focus with people on how can we get that in? Can we have purees? Can we have soups? Can we have soft cooked vegetables and things like that rather than a gigantic salad? Because we're just not going to have room for that.
What if you just take a multivitamin?
It's not going to be the same, unfortunately, but it is one of the things that I do recommend. Let's go back to thinking about if we're going to take these things maybe for a long time, a multivitamin isn't going to give us enough nutrition. So what we know about vitamins and nutrients in food is there's a synergistic or symbiotic effect in food. When we just take vitamins, packaged gummies, chewables, whatever, we don't know what the absorption rate will be, and we don't know how those nutrients will be incorporated into our bodies. There are studies on certain nutrients that indicate that anywhere from a fifth to half of the dose on a vitamin is actually absorbed.
So take a multivitamin, but it's not going to move your needle.
Yeah. So protein, fiber, hydration. And then we look at what else might be missing. So calcium is an important one, especially, again, for us midlifers who are at risk for bone loss. So that's another thing that I tend to focus on with people. I absolutely recommend a multivitamin. If somebody's struggling with fiber and is really struggling with regularity, a fiber supplement can also be helpful. But the supplements really can't necessarily take the place of food. So I think this comes back to, at the end of the day, if people are finding I can barely eat a meal, then that probably means the dose is too high and we're going to see some health issues, whether it's nutritional deficiencies for women who are still menstruating. They might find that their period stops. We might find thyroid issues. We might find people's hair falling out. So these are all signs of things are not going great in the body.
In fact, very bad, right? If you are stopping your period, that's
But that's very common in women that lose weight too quickly. So that's, again, why I'm here, not to be really scary, but to think about we really would prefer to have weight loss anywhere in the half a kilo to a kilo a week on average. The first month, I think, when people take these meds, it can be significantly more because we have water weight and things like that.
Also, you're not used to it. Right. I remember actually being here recording, and I think I had a little yogurt or something in the morning, and I forgot.
Yeah,
and exactly. I was like, oh my God, it's 3 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. It really can be. And I think it's mind-blowing for some people who maybe felt
tied to food.
Yeah, tied to food or ruled by food. It can be actually a welcome. Like, I'm not thinking about food all the time. I'm not constantly planning when I'm going to eat next. And I absolutely understand that. And I think that makes a lot of sense. The problem is then we go from one extreme to another. Mm-hmm. And so we want to get out of thinking about food as this horrible, scary, awful thing that we have to control. We have to get in the mindset of it's something that actually nourishes us and is healthy, and we need to try and find somehow a happy medium. And one of my bigger kind of concerns with the meds and the way they're prescribed is, number one, most doctors, like I said, don't necessarily screen for eating disorders first. But in my experience, most doctors also don't require the patients that they prescribe these to go and meet with a dietitian or a nutritionist. And I think it's really important because we don't get into situations with food noise and all those things just by accident. They've been patterns for a while in most people's lives, and the medication may be something they can take for long term, but may not. We still have issues with insurance and prices and supply and things like that. So one of my biggest focus areas is really continue to try and work with people on what is your relationship to food. And let's not go from one where it ruled your life to one where now you fully ignore it. Like, somewhere in the middle, we want to find a place where food can be comforting and nourishing and part of your life without you ignoring it or you thinking about it 24/7.
I totally hear what you're saying. It's a great idea if you're going to go on one of these and you're making that decision to see a nutritionist, dietitian. I hear what you're saying about food noise. I actually find that this was my first Christmas on the medicine, and it was sad because food used to be very exciting.
Yep.
In general, things used to be very exciting. It dampens your dopamine, which is a bummer.
That absolutely is something I hear from people, and can just acknowledge the elephant in the room. Both you and I maybe are ADHD.
Oh, yeah. I was like, elephant, what are you about to drop?
So one of the things that I do notice as a dietitian is that, yeah, individuals with ADHD have not sufficient or irregularly circulated dopamine. And so food can become something that provides dopamine. And so one of the cool things I do think about these meds are, is they are being used, looked at in areas of whether it's substance abuse or ADHD, because the meds aren't just affecting our pancreas and our insulin sensitivity. They're not just affecting how quickly food digests. They are affecting the reward system in the brain. Well.
Yeah, I really don't care about drinking anymore.
Yeah.
I'm happy to. I can't drink nearly as much, but I don't even think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think in that perspective, again, if we could find the best optimal dose that didn't cause muscle loss and nutritional deficiencies and things like that. So I think that's where I'm hopeful that research continues and we find really good on-ramps. If it's not an off-ramp, a maintenance set of programs,
okay,
so that we're minimizing some of the bad stuff, but we're taking advantage of some of the good stuff.
Question about that.
Yeah.
If you find that you're on a low dose. Okay, so let's say you've been on it for a month, because you mentioned like the first month is wild. Mm-hmm. There's a lot happening. Month or two, but you're still feeling like you really can't eat three meals a day, for example. Is that a sign? Let's say you're on the lowest dose and you can't do that. Is that a sign that maybe you need to go, instead of once a week, once every 10 days, slow down the dosage?
In general, in the U.S., doctors would probably do that. My understanding is that in general here in Europe, they're still really prescribing on label in terms of weekly doses and a very specific stepped up dosage schedule. So I think we will see more studies and then potentially some guidelines around that. And I don't typically, I've had several dozen clients taking these that I've seen in the last year or two. I don't typically see that on that very lowest dose.
That they can't.
Yeah. What I do sometimes see is at the beginning of the next dose, and there are a number of side effects that we obviously haven't even talked about here. There can be nausea, there can be constipation, there can be low appetite, headaches, fatigue, et cetera, et cetera. But I usually see with people that the first couple days of that injection at that next step up is usually the most challenging, and then things settle down. So that's one of the other things I counsel people about is, what can you do if your appetite's really low for a few days, or you're feeling nauseous, or you're struggling to get enough food in? So then we'll look at meal replacements and protein shakes and sipping liquids that are rich in nutrients over the course of the day. Mm. So we're still trying to get all the nutrients in. We might just not be chewing them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really good tip, because it is true. Like, even if I go up a dose, for example, I will know that I will be too tired to work out.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody responds to the meds differently. And we also talk about timing. Is it better for you to feel fatigued and a little meh over the weekend? Or is it better on a Monday? And so thinking about what your side effects are, how do we mitigate those? Whether it's nausea, ginger tea can be really great. If it's constipation, we'll look at kiwis. Kiwis are a great tool, by the way, for constipation. And then I really do look at what their intake is. So I ask people, like, tell me what you've been eating in general, how many times a day. I don't make them track protein or fiber or things like that. But we go through a general sort of recall of their eating. And if I think, gosh, I didn't hear any calcium in there, we talk about that. Or I only heard like one vegetable, we might want to look at that. So it's really individualized, I think. Going back to your muscle question, I do focus on protein. I do look at different ways to get protein. And then one of the things that I really try and do is assess people's body composition. So that goes back to,
yeah. Stand on the scale?
Yeah, and not your bathroom scale, because it's not going to be good enough. So one of, whether it's an InBody or some other body composition tool that you can, I have them in my office. Most dietitians do. A lot of the gyms and Salle du Sport have them. But what I really like to do is have people do one of those right when they start the med. And then every couple of months, we'll check them again to see. And so that, along with how are they feeling, what's the rate of weight loss, it's really fast. We think about maybe we need to eat more. I assess their nutrition to make sure that they're hitting all the markers. I do recommend that people get labs every 3 to 6 months, depending on what their doctor says.
How often do you see labs coming back in an adverse way? Because I need to do labs. It's been about 6 months and I need to do it.
Again, it depends on the person. If somebody is really not eating well and I'm seeing that they're also not feeling well and they've lost weight quickly, and then we look at their body composition, I'm like, ooh, you're still losing quite a bit of muscle. I'm definitely going to ask somebody to go talk with their doctor and get some labs and just check to make sure, even if they're already taking a multivitamin. If we're low in iron, a multivitamin's not going to do enough. Most multivitamins also aren't going to have enough calcium. They're not going to have enough vitamin D. So there may be other things to look at. But I think body composition, while there's no science to what is the right amount of fat versus lean mass to lose, we can see if the muscle mass loss is accelerating faster than the fat mass, that's a problem.
For sure.
Basically, I just have a dashboard where I'm looking at a number of different things for people and making sure that we're hitting on all of those things.
So if you decide to take one of these, you definitely need to have weight training be in your...
Yes. So that was the last piece, for sure. The reality is protein alone isn't going to protect your muscle. Protein is the thing that is going to help you synthesize new muscle. And that only comes through weight training and strength
training. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So I have a friend who is single mom, really works hard all the time.
Yeah.
And she wants to lose weight and she wants to go on one of these, but she's just lifting weights. It's just not going to work. So does that mean she's a bad candidate?
It could potentially be problematic. It also, again, depends on the dose. It depends on overall nutrition. Thinking about people that we talked about, yourself included, where you just stop thinking about food. I'm not that interested in food. In that case, if we're not getting enough nutrition overall, then the weight loss is likely going to be more rapid. Again, not getting enough protein and not strength training, then we are going to enter more of that risk area.
Got it.
So I think we can modulate some of this by being relatively cautious. And I think that doctors generally feel the same. With any medication, the lowest effective dose is where we want to be.
I'm so glad you brought that up because it seems like you're pushing a low and slow kind of methodology to this. However, when I go to the pharmacy and I'm like, should I go up a dose or not? And the pharmacist is like, if you tolerate it, then yeah. Like you want to get to the top of it, which I actually think maybe is a mistake.
Yeah, I can't speak for a pharmacist or other doctors, but I think in general with medications, and I work closely with several GPs, the lowest dose of anything is always going to be, that's effective, is always going to be the best place to be. Because if it's effective and it's low, then we have a lower risk profile, right? Every time we go up in a dose of anything, we have more risks of side effects. That's just, it's called the dose response relationship. That's just how it works. So when it comes to the meds, again, there's a lot of different pieces in play. If the dose is so high that people's nutrition then is poor, that's a problem. If the dose is so high that people just don't have enough energy to work out or whatever, that's also a challenge. So thinking, or if they have lots of side effects, whether it's nausea or then they're starting to have gallbladder issues or pancreatitis, there are some other more severe side effects that can come with the meds. I do believe, and again, this comes from my nutritional background more than anything, because of the whole idea of weight cycling and the more rapid that weight comes off, the more challenges we have in our body. And then if we have to stop the medication because our nutrition is bad and we're feeling awful, the faster that weight comes back on, which can then add on additional impacts.
What if you've hit a plateau?
Plateaus are normal in weight loss in general. So that's one of the first things that I remind people is our bodies don't know that we're doing this on purpose. Our bodies only know that they're being starved in their view, right? So our bodies have lots of ways that they compensate and slow things down to make sure it's evolutionary, to make sure that they're safe. So our metabolism can slow down. Different hormones in our bodies shift to maintain what we call homeostasis. So it's very typical in any weight loss program that we're going to hit a plateau because our body says, whoa, I'm not sure what's happening here, but I think I need to protect us because it feels like we might be in a famine.
How long do plateaus last?
I think it really depends on the person. It depends also how many diets and things you've been on, because our bodies do metabolically shift over time and they become more sensitive to perceived famine or starvation. So it can be a week or a couple of weeks. It's hard to say, but it is something that I often counsel people on. Don't panic. Don't rush immediately into the next dose. In fact, I had a patient a few weeks ago who hadn't lost any weight. I think he was in his third or fourth month of the medication and hadn't lost any weight.
Since the beginning.
So he'd been on the medication for 3 or 4 months. And then he was maybe 4 months in and he hadn't lost any weight in three plus weeks. And it was very distressing for him. And he wanted to go up in dose. So he did. And then he came back a couple weeks later and he couldn't eat at all. It's hard because if you felt uncomfortable with your body for a really long time, if you felt out of control with food or not good, it's really tempting to just not have to think about it. But we also know that plateaus are normal and usually your body's going to get past it. Sometimes our bodies slow down even more so when we're eating less, right? So sometimes it's a matter of, like I say, stay on this dose, but I actually want you to eat more this week. I want you to actively eat more food. Because there can be alarm signals in the body that are like, whoa, this is crazy. Like, we don't know what's happening. So we're going to shut down our metabolism, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a number of different ways of, I think, approaching those.
Another question for the long term. Obviously, you can't just lose weight forever until you die.
Correct.
So does this max out at some point?
This is what I'm talking about. Our body really does have what we call set points or adjustments to its normal functioning systems to slow them down in times of low food intake. This goes back to where thyroid issues could come in, or women could lose their period, or our hair falls out. Our body stops focusing on what it thinks are less necessary functions because it's trying to keep the lights on in our brain and our heart and our lungs and our digestive system. When we start to see those symptoms, we know our body's not happy and that's not a place we want to be.
And those things only happen if you eat way not enough calories.
It depends on the person, interestingly enough. Sometimes those things can happen even in individuals with BMIs over 30. It can happen if the weight is too rapid.
I see.
And the body becomes alarmed by the rapidity and the scale of the nutritional deficiencies and will slow things down. Yeah, our bodies, we would be a really terrible species if we could just keep losing weight until we died.
So like eventually your body's going to have stasis.
Yeah. Most people are going to hit what we would call a set point, a point where your body feels in general safe and is functioning well, and it's not going to go lower without a lot more effort. The problem is a lot of times our bodies opinion of where it should be and our opinions of where we want that weight to be are mismatched. That's when we try and push it farther. And in fact, I have a metaphor that I sometimes use with some of my patients. And you think about going to the beach or the swimming pool and you have those big fluffy sort of plastic beach balls that kids will try and lay on and shove them under the water. And if you get enough leverage on them, you can push that whole thing under the water.
I know where you're going with this.
But then the second that you move, it pops back up again. And that's really true with our bodies. If we try and push our bodies into a place they don't want to be, they might go there. But number one, we're probably not going to feel really good. And we're going to have some of those symptoms we talked about before. And number two, it's probably not going to stay there. And so what I talk about with clients and patients is that the healthiest weight for your body isn't always going to be what you want it to be. It's going to be a weight where you feel good, you're healthy, you don't have a lot of symptoms and side effects from poor nutrition, and it's going to be a place where you can eat in a way that's generally satisfying and nourishing and ideally not have to obsess about food.
If you're on these medicines for a long time, just the aging process may also happen. So how can you necessarily pinpoint, oh, my hair is thinning. Is it because of menopause or perimenopause on hormonal changes? Or is it because of GLP-1 or bone loss or things like that? Like, how can you know? How can you really know?
It's a great question. And I think the reality comes back to, we have to look at all of the pieces. So we have to look at, again, what's our age? Where are we in the whole perimenopause, menopause cycle? We have to look at any other health conditions that might be affecting bone or hormones. But what we do know about the menopause transition, similar to what I talked about with age-related muscle loss, we have natural things that happen with aging. When we come into the perimenopause transition, women can lose up to 20% of their total bone mass within the 5 years that surround that menopause transition.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot. That's related to estrogen. So estrogen protects a lot of other things, but it does protect our bones. One of the reasons, again, that I'm really focused on this topic is because you're right. We already have all these things happening to us, and we don't want to accelerate those. So I don't know if we can tell, did bone loss come from the GLP-1 or from aging? But what we can know is we sure as heck don't want to add any additional momentum to what's already happening. So thinking about nutrition, thinking about strength training, when I do see midlife women that are going to take these, I recommend that they get a DEXA scan, like as a baseline. Doctors more and more are getting pretty good at that. It used to be you wouldn't get one until your 60s, until maybe you actually broke or fractured something.
Oh, wow.
And by then, we don't necessarily have a sense of, did you lose? What was happening? So getting a baseline DEXA scan along with like body composition and things like that gives us a framework to see, where are we at now? And then ideally, with the body composition, we're checking that every 3 months or so to keep an eye on it and adjusting the diet as needed. DEXA scan depends on your doctor and the CNS. You may or may not be able to get one every year, but at least every couple of years.
You can always pay out of pocket though, right?
I believe so. It's hard to get one in the city, I will say that. I did my first DEXA scan here in Luxembourg about 6 months ago and drove up to Vilts.
Oh.
You can actually almost get same-day appointments.
Oh, good tip, good tip.
Yes.
Also,
yes.
I would just want to plug that I have an episode coming out about perimenopause and menopause, and it's really fabulous. And yours is coming up first. So if you're listening to this one, stay tuned for that one. Diana, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me for the third time.
You're my hero. Okay, bye.
Bye.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you like the show, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment, or better yet, share with another mom friend. And if there's a topic you'd like to see covered or you want to be on the show yourself, please email me at momlife@rtl.lu. And if you're feeling social, you can always reach me on Facebook and Instagram at Mom Life in Luxembourg. Thanks so much and have a great day.